The House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum, and we will begin with Representative Gander moving the minutes from April 9th, 2026. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from April 9th, 2026, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is approved, and the minutes are adopted. First up today, we have House File 4421. I will move that House File 4421 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Duran, the bill is in front of us. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want to move the amendment first to get the bill into the shape that I would like? Or?
Yes, I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill into the shape that you would like to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment is just deleting section 3 of the bill to cut back on the committee stops it needs to go to so we can continue to work on this. That's it.
Always a good idea. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Duran, to your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak on 4421 today. This bill addresses county cost share requirements for economically distressed counties. Communities that are facing significant structural challenges through no fault of their own. Under House File 4421, an economically distressed county is defined as the two following criteria. More than 50% of the population is living in poverty, and 70% of the county's total acreage is exempt from property taxes underneath Chapter 272. These criteria capture a very real and pressing issue. Counties meeting this definition often have a limited tax base, not because of the lack of effort or poor management, it is because much more of their land is non-taxable. At the same time, they're serving populations with higher levels of need. This creates a difficult imbalance battling greater demand for services with fewer local resources to fund them. House File 4421 is about fairness and practicality. By providing relief from cost-sharing requirements, this bill helps ensure the counties are not penalized for circumstances beyond their control. Instead, it gives them the flexibility to continue delivering critical services to their community. Whether that's public safety, health and human services, or infrastructure to the residents who rely most. As legislators, we are responsible for crafting policies that work for all Minnesotans, including those in communities facing the steepest challenges. This bill reflects that commitment. It is a targeted, thoughtful step towards ensuring no county is left behind simply because of its economic realities. I strongly believe this legislation will make a meaningful difference for those who need our support the most. Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your time and consideration. With that, I would like to turn it over to the testifiers who can speak further on the real-world impacts of this bill.
Representative Duran, first on the agenda, we have Tom Berry on Zoom. Welcome to the meeting, Mr. Berry. If you please state your name for the record and present your testimony. All right, next on the agenda, we have Ann Linseth from the Health and Human Services area from Beltrami County, also on Zoom.
I bet it would help if I had my microphone on. First, we have Tom Berry from the Beltrami County Administrator on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony. Okay, maybe if I wear a wig. Is Ann Linseth available? Very good.
Hello, good morning. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
All right, good morning, Chair Noren Schumacher and members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. My name is Ann Linseth, and I'm the Health and Human Services Director with Beltrami County. I'm here today to express support for HF 4421, which modifies county cost share responsibilities for economically distressed counties. I'm hoping that you're able to hear from Administrator Berry on our unique property tax base and resource challenges. But in addition to those challenges, we also have three of our five Region 2 counties, which is over 60% of our region, that rank among the highest in poverty statewide. As a regional hub, Beltrami County absorbs higher service demands, not only from our own residents, but also from surrounding areas. The comprehensive result is significant strain to Beltrami County's resources. Not only is Beltrami County have a limited tax base, but we also have disproportionate need for services and consistently higher utilization rates due to poverty and other social determinants of health. Some statistics to share related to Beltrami County is that we have more than double the state average of people who are receiving medical assistance, almost 40% of our population. We have over five times the state average of individuals who receive family cash assistance programs. We have over nine times the state average of neonatal abstinence syndrome births, and our child mortality rate is almost double the state average. In addition to that, Beltrami County needs over 6,000 housing units in the next 10 years to provide adequate housing resources for our residents. Poor social determinants of health, such as the ones I listed, as well as trauma, limited local resources, and economic stress, drive the need for high-level services and supports in both the mental health and substance use arenas. Our limited tax base, coupled with high utilization, limits our ability to cover costs associated with these services. Also, when our limited resources are directed towards cost shares, we lose the ability to reinvest in our own community. This bill would waive cost shares in two critical areas, state hospital costs and the Behavioral Health Fund, both areas with limited ability for counties to control the costs. State hospital costs are high, they increase annually, they fluctuate unpredictably due to a number of variables. And the Behavioral Health Fund, counties have lost oversight and authority with the implementation of direct access a number of years ago, and now even more so with the transition of the Behavioral Health Fund eligibility determination moving to the state. So counties with high numbers of low-income individuals have more residents who are ultimately eligible for the Behavioral Health Fund. In closing, requiring counties with small tax bases and high poverty to shoulder rising mandatory service costs only exacerbates existing challenges, and it undermines our ability to serve our most vulnerable residents. Economically distressed counties need a different framework that reflects our fiscal realities. And for those reasons, we strongly encourage you to support HF 4421. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Linseth, for your testimony. Next, I understand that Mr. Berry is available now, so welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Berry. Is everyone able to hear and see me okay?
We can hear you. Welcome.
Excellent. Thank you. I apologize for the technical glitch. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. Again, my name is Tom Berry. I'm the County Administrator for Beltrami County. I'm here to ask for your support in passing House File 4421. Beltrami County is an economically distressed county. We're the third largest county in the state of Minnesota, yet only 24% of our geographic area taxable. The rest includes federal and state lands, nearly 1,000 square miles of tribal lands. This severely limits our ability to generate revenue. At the same time, we are the second poorest county in Minnesota. Our median household income is 25% below the state average, and our population's reliance on state assistance is more than double the state's average. Recent state actions have created an unsustainable burden for us. In Beltrami County alone, we face nearly $200 million in new state cost pressures. In the past 5 years, state requirements have forced us to build a new jail at a financed cost of $165 million and will require us to close our landfill 10 years early, necessitating another $10 million investment. In the past 3 years alone, we have had to make extraordinary financial decisions, including raising property taxes 25%, adding a new 30-year 5/8% sales tax, eliminating 7 health and human services staff positions, cutting 50% of transit and library funding, selling county land to raise money, raising service fees, and taking on over $75 million in new debt. And still, we face an additional $2 to $3 million in new state cost shifts annually. Our geography, our limited tax base, and socioeconomic realities leave us especially vulnerable to state-imposed cost shifts. We've done everything that we can. We've tightened our belts again and again. We've developed new taxes. We've raised existing taxes. We've made difficult service reduction choices, and we've stretched every dollar. We have endured all that we can, and now we're asking for your help. Please support House File 4421. Partner with us to help our community, ensuring that well-intended state policies do not place disproportionate financial strain on economically distressed counties like ours. Thank you very much for your time, your favorable consideration, and your service to our great state.
Thank you, Mr. Berry, for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 4421 as amended? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions from members? Representative Keeler.
Thank you. How many counties identify in this, like the 15% or more living in poverty? How many of our 87 counties?
Representative Duran.
I believe it would be two or three counties would actually fit that. And I believe Manoman, us, and Clearwater, I believe. Maybe it's Mr. Berry might actually have a better answer for you.
Mr. Berry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Duran. Yes, that's our understanding, is that it would be two to three counties, and the counties that were identified are the counties that we are tracking as well.
Representative Keeler.
So we're sure it's Beltrami, Manoman, and Clearwater?
Representative Duran.
Yes.
Okay, so of those, two of those have tribal nations connected to them. Also, I just want to say a couple things, because one of the testifiers mentioned that 40% of Beltrami County utilizes MA. This is huge. When we talk about rural Minnesota and what's happening and how many people utilize some of these services that the federal government now is completely shutting off, and as a state that is county-ran, state-supervised, you should be advocating to the federal government to stop doing what they're doing to us. Your county is one of the number one counties that's getting impacted from services, and now you're coming to us to say we need to do something different, when the truth is it is somebody else's fault. There is a reason why your services are going to be stretched so far. And also the new jail, I just want to acknowledge that Beltrami County incarcerates Native women at a much higher rate than any other like county in this state, and it's ridiculously high. So to talk about new jails, and you can huff and puff all you want in the back, this is reality, and we can talk about whatever we want at this table. You can roll your eyes. I don't think that that's appropriate. But the truth is there are a lot of issues that are happening in your county because of federal fall down. And you have to be honest about that. You have to know that your county is very, very, very uniquely different, and we see the outcomes of that. So coming here and testifying on this is like a very small sliver of what your county actually needs you to be doing because of the Medicaid and all of these SNAP benefits that are rolling down that are putting a lot of the pressure on your county's back, making what the federal government doing is actually an unfunded mandate to counties. So I have a hard time when you come here and you make us as the state try to change something because the federal government is harming your county. So I just need you to be very, very aware of the numbers that were shared are really scary. And it is not just the state's responsibility to fix this. It is something that your county needs to be better at. The way that you function in your county needs to be more holistic and more partnership with the tribes. We've said that over and over and over. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Duran.
Yes, thank you for that, actually. And I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I am also talking to the federal government about this stuff as well. So I'm talking to my congressmen about our troubles in Beltrami County. So this isn't just me coming here and automatically looking for a handout from the state of Minnesota. I'm working all the angles I can possibly. But you got to realize that the state of Minnesota has not been too friendly to the state of Minnesota's population as a whole. We've put a lot of mandates, and we've increased costs in the state of Minnesota all the way around. So, yes, we have been a part of the problem. So we have to take responsibility for this as well. So when we're talking about, and I'm not going to jump into the incarceration deal, because I that's a rabbit hole we can talk maybe offline, because I don't think that you're fairly representing that properly. So, but what I'm trying to say right now is that we need to start looking at some of the people that need the help the most. And that is the people inside my county. And that's why I'm here advocating for right now. I'm here asking for the state of Minnesota to stop hurting the community that I live in. And I'm looking for us to maybe change the ways that we're doing things. So I appreciate some of the conversations that continue down the road advocating for this. I'd be willing to work with anybody. I'll be willing to work with you to make sure that this gets through. I have no problem with that. But we need to start looking at different ways, because we in the state of Minnesota are not looking very good financially as well. So I'm looking to help out my community anywhere I can. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Durant, for bringing this bill forward. I just have a quick question. So there are two sections that we are changing in this bill, the Behavioral Health Fund. Do you know how much is the cost to the county, Beltrami County, for the Behavioral Health Fund?
Representative Durant.
I will have to refer that to actually Ms. Linseth or Mr. Berry in regards to that.
Chair Noor and Schumacher, thank you. The answer to that question is, for the Behavioral Health Fund, Beltrami County expends approximately $160,000 annually. That's an average over the last 5 years, because it does fluctuate quite a bit.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has there been an effort to make sure that we move people to medical assistance so that we can, you know, serve the same population in a different role rather than depending on the behavioral health?
Ms. Linseth.
Chair Noor and Schumacher and the committee, yes, there is. When we receive a Behavioral Health Fund application, we make every effort to have that family or household complete an MA application to determine that eligibility. I will note that with the transfer of the Behavioral Health Fund to the state, that will be more challenging for counties.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the second change in this bill, it's the MSOP section. How much is the cost to the county, Beltrami County, for that portion of the fund?
Representative Durand.
I would have to refer back to Ms. Linseth on that as well.
Ms. Linseth.
Chair Noor, Schumacher Committee, the average cost annually for direct care and treatment costs to Beltrami County is $974,000. Again, that is an average over the last 5 years, as if that cost also fluctuates quite a bit.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some of this provisions, the two sections that are mentioned here, I think we can mitigate some of it, and I think we have to come up with a plan to support the county so that we can have more of an expedited process based on Medicaid or medical assistance program. And the MSOP, it has been more tradition, and also the work that if you place individuals in the state system, there's a cost sharing for the county. And quite frankly, some of the times it's because of the transfers that happen for those who don't meet medical criteria. So we've got more conversation on some of this process. Maybe we can come up with a better plan in how to address it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Is there anyone else who wishes to offer any questions or comments? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about, you know, what the public land looks like. Who all owns it, you know, between Fed, state, others? And then you know, what percent it is in your county?
Representative Durand.
Most of that is going to be state and federal lands, but Mr. Berry can actually explain a little bit more in detail of how that all sets up if we want to refer
briefly, Mr. Berry.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So our taxable area is 24.7%, 35.3% is state land, 15.7% is tribal land, again, state and tribal non-taxable. U.S. government land is almost 4%. That's, I think, the categories you were generally looking for.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think that the one thing I was just pointing out there, it's, you know, unfair to the people that are carrying the burden of taxes for a lot of these services, in that we have so much of our land that's actually non-taxable, and so the balance has to be taken with the rest of the property tax owners. So it's a little bit unfair for their county. Thanks.
Representative Durand, final word.
I appreciate you guys hearing this, and we're willing to work with anybody to make this thing better for us as a body here, and thank you for your time.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4421, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion passes, and the House File 4421, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Taxes. Thank you, Representative Duran. Next, we have House File 1937, Representative Ryer. I will move that House File 1937 be laid over. Representative Ryer, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, committee members. Chair, I would ask that perhaps we'd introduce the amendment first, and then I can speak to the entire bill.
That sounds good, Representative Ryer. I will move the A26-0136 to be before the committee. Representative Ryer, to your amendment.
Thank you. I will talk about the entire thing as a whole, if that's all right. What the amendment does is basically defines the scope of making this a proposal for a pilot program rather than a full-scale implementation.
Okay. Any questions to the amendment before we get the bill into the shape that the author intends? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A26-0136, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Ryer, to your amendment.
Thank you so much, Chair. This morning I'm here to talk about the program of all-inclusive care for the elderly, or PACE. As a reminder, PACE is a federal program that creates an integrated system of care for older adults who are eligible for nursing home care but wish to remain in their own homes and communities of choice. PACE provides a comprehensive range of medical and social services, transportation, meals, social activities, and other supports to help vulnerable seniors stay active and engaged. It's widely used to provide culturally appropriate options for care. In 2023, we funded an actuarial study and implementation plan as required by the federal government. These reports were completed in 2024. Since then, we've been exploring a variety of paths to establish active PACE programs in Minnesota. House File 1937, as amended, proposes that we implement a pilot program to test interest in PACE, its suitability for Minnesota communities, and outcomes of the program for its participants. This pilot program would authorize contracts with two PACE organizations. One must be in the 7-county metro area and one outside that area. Eligible participants must meet federal requirements and be a member of a vulnerable population with specific long-term care needs. PACE organizations will be selected through a competitive bid process, and services will be authorized for up to 500 participants. Finally, the why. PACE delivers better health outcomes. It can prevent hospitalizations and nursing home placements, while also allowing seniors to age in place in their own communities. PACE can be cost-effective for both the state and federal government, generating cost savings compared to traditional fee-for-service Medicare and Medicaid programs, and providing high-quality care at a lower cost compared to Medicare Advantage plans, nursing homes, and waivers. Very importantly, people like it. Multiple studies report high satisfaction for participants and reduced stress for family members. I hope that we can make this modest implementation step to confirm whether PACE is right for Minnesota seniors. And now I'd like to turn it over to testifiers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. First, we have Eric Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Nelson. I am the Regional Vice President of PACE Operations for Volunteers of America National Services. PACE stands for Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. It is a proven integrated care model that wraps a multitude of services around the participant with a focus on keeping participants living in the community for as long as possible, while also receiving high quality of care. PACE serves nursing home eligible participants that are deemed safe to live in the community. PACE covers all Medicare Parts A, B, and D benefits, all Medicaid covered medical and long-term care benefits, including skilled nursing facilities, and any other services or supports that are medically necessary to maintain or improve the health of the participants. Some examples of these services are transportation, social services, therapy, dietary activities, primary care, and home care, to name a few. A PACE program administers some of these services at its day center. The day center also provides a great setting for participants to socialize and interact. Another benefit of PACE is the unique financing structure and the flexibility it provides in delivering comprehensive, person-centered care. PACE operates on a capitated payment model, with programs receiving fixed monthly payments for each enrolled participant from Medicare and Medicaid. PACE is currently offered in 33 states and the District of Columbia. PACE is serving over 90,000 participants across 201 PACE programs. The PACE industry has seen rapid growth over the last few years. This growth is brought on by more and more states recognizing the value of PACE and the value it brings as another health care and long-term care option for their constituents. Over 90% of family caregivers in PACE would recommend PACE. Likewise, PACE participants rated their satisfaction as 4 out of 5. That, combined with the quality impacts of lower hospitalization rates, decreased rehospitalizations, reduced ER visits, and less nursing home admissions, states are seeing the positive impact PACE can have on their population. Using a demonstration model for PACE in Minnesota will allow the state time to learn and understand the model and how it better fits into the continuum of care that is offered to its constituents. The demonstration will also give seniors in Minnesota another great option that allows them to age in their homes and communities with dignity and access to high-quality care they deserve. By allowing an urban and rural demonstration, the state will also be able to see how PACE is able to serve both urban and rural communities. These demonstrations further allow the state to enact PACE in a more measured approach to demonstrate its cost-effectiveness to be able to apply the PACE model as an effective way to address a tighter Medicaid budget in the future. 33 states have fully embraced PACE as a cost-effective, high-quality, high-satisfaction alternative to nursing home care and managed long-term care. This alternative in Minnesota is long overdue. Thank you for your time today and anticipated support in bringing PACE to Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, for your testimony. Next, we have Chelsea Olson from the Council of Health Plans. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association for the nonprofit health insurers in Minnesota. That's Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, and Sanford Health Plan of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 1937. We testified last year with concerns around the PACE program implementation, that unlike many other states that have instituted a PACE program, Minnesota already has the MSHO program in place that accomplishes much of what PACE aims to accomplish. At the time, we had recommended the state should adopt a pilot program approach before implementing anything broader. We appreciate that the adopted amendment scopes the bill to a pilot program with annual reporting around performance metrics. We look forward to working collaboratively with Representative Ryer and stakeholders to ensure quality care is provided to Minnesota seniors. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1937 as amended? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for bringing this. I know it sounds like maybe three things we're trying to accomplish with this. Allow folks to age in place or live at home as long as they possibly can, maybe save some cost, and of course, somewhere tucked into there, going for better outcomes for these folks, whatever that might look like. Medically, you know, we see, of course, in this population, there's a certain amount of decline. Their medical conditions become more complex, and perhaps all of that could be slowed if they have their normal social connections still going on, right? So there's a lot of good that can come from this. My first question is, how do we know, is this a 5-year window? How do we know at the end of this period, did we make it better? Do we have a control group over here that is still in the traditional nursing home facility with a similar acuity level starting up to know, did this group do better in these three areas at the end of the time period?
Mr. Nelson or Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair. I just must make one comment. As a researcher, you're speaking right to my heart on control groups, although it would be a comparison group because Ooh. It wouldn't be randomly assigned. But, you know, but in seriousness, I think it's important to look at the impact of things. And it's not defined at that level of detail, and I would love to have you in the conversation.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at the end of 5 years, we've been at this table when programs end, And suppose the folks are thriving, and suppose that they are having better outcomes, but the costs went through the roof. Hypothetically, what would we do at that juncture?
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Of course, that will depend on the will and the makeup of the future legislature, as well as the existence of programs at the federal level. There are so many things impossible to predict there. My belief in the goodness of people is that the legislature of 5 years from now will be putting the interests of those individuals and families very close to the center and finding ways to resolve the situation if the program must be ended or transformed.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand this is kind of functioning as a managed care organization, kind of under capitation, so there should be some cost containment built into that. And do I also understand this is kind of a wraparound that would be so all-inclusive that you wouldn't get nickeled and dimed to death?
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. So PACE is funded by capitation for Medicare and Medicaid, and any costs outside of what is provided is our responsibility as the provider. It's not a pass-through. We don't submit expenses to Medicaid or Medicare for reimbursement. We're responsible for managing the care and then for the outcomes and providing the care. So costs are capped, if you will, and then anything above that is our responsibility. And so there are participants that we pay more than what we're getting reimbursed for, but that is the model and our responsibility.
Representative Gander.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And one final comment. If this goes well, if this happens, if it goes well, it could also be a bit of a model for folks with disabilities, right? Because our waiver system is so cobbled up, right? We know that. But what if something like this is very effective? It could carry over nicely even to folks with disabilities if we could do a wraparound, all-inclusive kind of a thing. Just a thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to take a little different approach than Representative Ganger did. What happens with the PACE organization if we have a hiccup? It doesn't go well financially or operates efficiently. What happens if it goes south?
Mr. Nelson.
Well, I guess it depends on the context of what you mean by going south. I mean, the costs are set by the state. They're capitated. So whether costs increase, we don't get to submit for the state to pay more. That is all determined by the state and the administrating agency. We can always, show our costs as to why we would maybe justify saying we need an increase, but the state is in charge of that. And so the only way, I guess, if you're talking about going south is either if participant satisfaction wasn't where we deemed it would need to be, or, outcomes and operations of the program aren't where they need to be, then, yeah, that discussion would have to be had from a state administering level on what do we do with the program going forward.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, follow up. Thank you. So what type of metrics are going to be set up for accountability, to make sure the people are receiving the services that they need, making sure they don't spend more than what they bring in? So what type of accountability metrics could you address that, please?
Representative Nelson. Mr. Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. So that's going to vary depending on the state administering agency, and certainly there's some consistency across programs and across states, but usually that is all done through CMS audits. So we are audited by the federal government every year, and then we are also audited usually by state administering agencies, and those states, set the criteria, and we have our own regulations, whether they're federal and then state, to adhere to. And so, but that's always something that the state administering agency gets to set.
Representative Becker.
No further questions. Thank you.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Breyer, for bringing the pilot program. So going back to what we did previously, we did a study, and we also did the actual analysis to figure out if this is going to work. And quite frankly, it came out that there is no benefit. Number one, for the PACE is 55 and above, which is a provider-led model. versus the MSHO, which is more of a health plan integrated model, which when you look at the two, the study found out that there's no benefit to the state in comparison between PACE and MSHO, and also the other additional findings that we got from the study. How will this pilot program address the outcome of that report?
Mr. Nielsen.
Yes, thank you. I would comment to state the comparison isn't with PACE and MSHO. MSHO is a very small subset of what PACE can do. The comparison is more PACE versus long-term care. And the cost between what the state pays a PACE program is significantly less than what the state pays nursing homes to provide the care. That's where more of the cost saving is generated. So the comparison really should be PACE to long-term care, not PACE to MSHO, because MSHO is a much smaller subset.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Noor. I'd also add that we see things in practice that actuarial analyses don't always reveal because they make assumptions, and that's why you go to the next step of a pilot to get the actual experience. And I would also point out that if all the financials were even across all of the categories, if that were the case, if we had better outcomes, if we had better quality of life, better experiences for people, that in itself would be worth having this option available.
Chair Noor. Final word, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the consideration, the thoughts from the members, and look forward to next steps. Thanks.
With that, House File 1937, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Next, we have Representative Nadeau with House File 4675. I will move House File 4675 to be laid over. Welcome to the committee. Whenever you're ready, Representative Nadeau, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. House File 4675 establishes a formal multi-stakeholder oversight body, specifically including counties, to ensure transparency, coordination, and accountability in human service IT decisions. As this committee knows, Minnesota is one of the few states where counties are asked to administer many of our benefit programs. As a county employee myself, I'm one of the few legislators that have actually worked in these systems. I'm very, very aware of the challenges county workers face in delivering Medicaid, cash assistance, SNAP, and other federally mandated programs. Section 1 of this bill creates the Human Services Steering Committee to oversee Minnesota's IT systems. It brings together state agencies, county representatives, and IT experts to guide system development, set priorities, and track funding. The 14-member with two ex officio committee meets at least quarterly, takes public input, and ensures transparency by recording all votes. Importantly, the state must consult the committee before making major system changes and must implement changes that receive at least 7 members' votes. Finally, the committee reports annually to the legislature on system funding, recommendations, and improvement needs. In short, it puts a formal structure in place to improve coordination, accountability, and decision-making for human services technology across the state. Section 2 of this bill provides one-time funding for fiscal year 2027 to modernize county human service IT systems in partnership with counties. It focuses in two areas. First, it's system improvements by expanding access to tools like Data Depot, automation and AI, improving user interfaces to replace outdated systems, enhancing eligibility platforms, and strengthening data integration and tracking. Second are the policy-driven updates, making system changes to align with legislative requirements. This includes automating eligibility checks, reducing duplicate data entry, simplifying SNAP reporting, improving accuracy in benefits processing, modernizing client notices, and adding automation like case noting. Overall, the goal is to make these systems more efficient, user-friendly, reduce error rates, and align with current policy while reducing the administrative burden on county workers. The bill contains an appropriation to support this work. I've left it open because it's going to be up to Chair Schumacher and Chair Knorr and others to decide the fate of this. And I want to thank Chair Schumacher for hearing the bill today. I want to thank Representative Vernig for pushing me on this bill and being a co-author. Lastly, I want to thank members for recognizing the urgency of this issue, recognizing that it affects all 87 counties and treating it in a bipartisan manner.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Who would you like as your first presenter?
Mr. Chair, I apologize. This is Matt Hilgart with the Association of Minnesota Counties. We're just trying to make sure that the laptop one cable is working properly. Apologize.
And Mr. Hilgart, is this your first time in front of this committee?
You would think so. Apologies. I apologize for this.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Knorr.
You can see that we already have a technology problem.
I thought I gave him plenty of time.
While that's loading, is someone ready to offer some testimony?
Mr. Holmes, you want to come up and speak? Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Jeannie Holland. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Knorr, and members. My name is Jeannie Holland. I'm a Wright County Commissioner. When I was first elected to the county board, I heard from others that the HHS department was using green screens. I thought they were joking. And so when I had a constituent issue, I went and it was jaw-dropping to see that they truly were using the green screen. As a county commissioner, I heard directly from constituents about delays in receiving benefits that they depend on. In Wright County, we take our customer service seriously, and our employees work hard to meet the mandates placed on us by both state and federal governments. But Maxis is making that nearly impossible. This is not a workforce problem. Our employees are capable. The system is failing them, and it is failing the residents that they serve. Benefits are delayed. Errors sometimes go undetected until money has already gone out the door. And staff are stretched to their limits trying to work around a system from the 1980s. We deserve a modern eligibility platform that is efficient, reliable, and built with program integrity. The state would never accept these types of inefficiencies for their workers, and it should not be assumed that the counties can. I'm asking for your support of House File 4675 to provide the funding necessary to bring Minnesota to 2026. Our constituents cannot afford to wait. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Holland. Mr. Hilgert, are you ready for us now?
We are. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, representatives. My name is Crystal Linder. My name is Crystal Linder. I'm a public assistance coordinator with Dakota County and the economic and employment area. I work in the training unit. Maxis is a system that made its debut in 1989. In the 10 years that I've worked within public assistance, it has had little to no adjustments or improvements made to the system, apart from adding an email line to the adder panel, which is the address panel, are one of the more significant and recent changes as we see on the jobs panel coming up here. They have added a cash pick window. This update has made for extra keystrokes with the worker not only needing to add income amount to the front-facing panel, but also within sub-panel windows called the pick windows. There has always been a snap pick window, and now there is a cash pick window. Both need to be added for accuracy. This gives us a total of 3 separate spots to put the income at this point. While the cash pick window update was made to help determine eligibility for family cash programs, it did not impact singles cash and still requires a workaround. The issue causes the worker to fiat, or in other words, override the system determination. For SNAP eligibility alone, there's a section in our poly temp 020602 that calls out 13 different reasons for fiating and instructions on how to fiat. As you can see, the worker is going through the fiat process for a singles cash known as general assistance. In this part of the fiating, the worker must list the income from the jobs panel a 4th time because it was not pulled over by the system, even though it was entered 3 other times. If you didn't catch it in that first time, don't worry. because the worker now will have to go through each of the consecutive months of eligibility after the first month of initial application, and they will update this. But there could, there usually is only one plus a month, but there could be potential for several other months. After fiating and approving GA eligibility, the worker then needs to go into the SNAP eligibility and fiat the SNAP eligibility determination. Before going over the SNAP eligibility, the worker needs to remember each month of the GA amount and what month it correlates with. So you'll see here at the end when they approve the GA, they need to remember the two amounts, because when they go into the SNAP eligibility, they need to put those two amounts into the SNAP budget. Luckily, though, when you do go over to fiat the SNAP eligibility amount, the income from the jobs panel does pull over, so that, I guess that's a benefit. It pulls over the listed amount into the budget for SNAP. However, the public assistance grant for general assistance that was just approved does not pull over. The GA amount is considered counted income and needs to be factored into the SNAP budget before approval. We fiat SNAP to include the GA amount to accurately get the correct SNAP allotment, and this is done for each month just like GA was. These are all manual numbers that are being typed in by the worker, so they need to be recorded often by hand, copy and pasted, which proves errors can happen. And so when the worker goes into fiat, they can put the correct numbers into the screen, as you can see that they were doing there. They are putting the general assistance amount into each of those SNAP fiat budgets. Workers have approximately 350 to 400 cases for adult SNAP and cash in Dakota County. Having to do this type of manual update for their cases adds extra time onto each case they process and extra keystrokes, and it's prone to more errors. This system is primarily a keyboard-based system, meaning no mouse manipulation is happening.
All right, thank you, Ms. Linder.
Good morning, Chair and Representatives. My name is Dana DeMaster, and I am the Director of Employment and Economic Assistance for Dakota County. MAXIS is just one of many systems that our financial workers need to use to determine eligibility for the programs. MAXIS handles cash and food as well as some health care. But another major system is METS, the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System. That's used to determine eligibility for another big chunk of medical assistance. METS came around in 2013, so it is significantly newer than MAXIS. And it does have some great improvements over MAXIS. First of all, you can use a mouse. So that's like really great, especially when you're training people in their 20s who, you know, have never seen something where you have to use codes to move around in that. But also for participants, they're able to apply online and their information auto-populates in the system, which one, alleviates the time that it takes for staff to have to enter information. Like in MAXIS, when someone applies online, our workers essentially get a PDF that takes about 45 minutes for them to hand enter the information that the participant already entered. METS takes care of that, and so that's really great. It also interfaces with some federal databases from things like asset verification, income, and immigration status. So again, that's really great and can move, reduces a lot of that inaccuracy, missed information, as well as data entry. However, that's about 45% of our cases, and we call those happy path. And so 45% of applications are happy path. The remainder end up going to the worker. And some reasons that something is not happy path is if someone entered their name as Mike instead of Michael, or if they are attached to a different case. So if you've got a parent with a child and they're on one household, the non-custodial parent applies for medical assistance separately, but they're associated with that other household due to them contributing to that child's financial well-being. Those all go to our worker and then have to be manually done. And so there definitely are some benefits. The other benefit would be that it has participants are able to upload their own documents. And so that's very easy when they apply. They can upload their verification documents. Other systems like MAXIS, counties have filled in that gap ourselves, and we fund and build our own participant portals, which then look different and feel different from county to county. So if you move from one county to another, your user experience of getting benefits will be quite different. So despite those good things, our workers much prefer to work in Maxis over Mets. It does take about 2 years to train someone to be a financial worker in medical assistance. And for some of those reasons is the long list of workarounds. And many of these are fairly recent. Since the pandemic, there have been a lot of policy changes, both related to the pandemic and other reasons like the recent immigration change in eligibility that have not been updated in Mets. And so there's workarounds that are very, very rigid. The policy manual for Mets is now over 1,000 pages long if you printed it. We don't even tell our workers to memorize the steps because they change frequently and they have to follow them exact. You make one mistake, you have to completely start over. Another long time workaround that's been around since Mets started was if you need to add a baby. So if someone has a baby, you have to completely close out their case and completely reopen it. One of the challenges is that that family who has an infant, and so it's already a stressful, overwhelming time in anybody's lives, now gets an auto-generated letter from the state saying their medical insurance closed. And so from our workers' perspective, you're dealing with the family and telling them, you're calling them and saying, okay, this letter is going to come, but please disregard it because you do have insurance, right? And so there's that added stress level and then the added work for our workers. Another the final issue I'll mention is that for long-term care and folks with certain disability eligibility for medical assistance are still in Maxis. And so you've got two different systems that don't talk, that people are having, you know, our staff are having to move between. But also for the people who are using these programs, if they become disabled, we have to close out their Mets case and then completely reopen it separately in Maxis, again, generating that auto closure notice at a time that I imagine has to be very stressful if you're looking at moving into long-term care and needing some long-term care type assistance. And so those are the quick overview of what makes Mets an improvement over Maxis, but also some significant challenges that we're facing. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Nora, and members. My name is Greg Kreiser. I'm the Wright County Administrator. The continued use of Maxis is a cost driver and a barrier to serving our residents. When operating in Maxis, our staff have to navigate 17 pages of documented workarounds, which we call fiats, where employees must manually override errors just to complete routine transactions. No long-term care application can be submitted without triggering an override error to complete the application. And even after overriding all those errors, staff still have to, at the end, manually add up all the assets by hand. Literally, our staff, after going through all the workarounds, all the pages, have to get out a calculator and add up the assets at the end. The learning curve for this system is not measured in weeks, but rather months in a calendar year. A new employee needs 2 months before they are minimally functionally able to work in the program. At 6 months, I have supervisors describing staff who are essentially in a fetal position, convinced they will never master the system. At 12 months, if we have managed to retain that employee, they are finally functionally productive. That's a full year investment before we see an employee at a functional usage of Maxis. What kind of business could ever operate on these underlying workforce conditions? Turnover in this area of work is high, and in turn, that turnover cost lands directly on our levy. Wright County taxpayers are subsidizing the inefficiency of an outdated state system every single time we post a job opening in our HHS department. Our current caseload runs from 250 to 330 cases per worker. With a modern system, a reasonable estimate puts that at double or triple. One of my HHS supervisors told me when she started in this field in 2002, there was already conversations about replacing Maxis. That was 24 years ago. I would ask that 2026 finally be the year we replace Maxis. I ask for your support on House File 4675. Our staff have earned it, our taxpayers have earned it, and frankly, so have the residents of Wright County in Minnesota who are waiting on the other end of every one of those fiats and workarounds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kreiser. Next, we have Matt Hilgert and Britta Torkelson. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Matt Hilgard, and this morning I will be speaking on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Rural Counties, with their leader, Britta Torkelson, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association with their executive director, Nathan Jessen. Mr. Chair, I want to thank the author for bringing this really important bill forward. I want to thank another co-author, Representative Vernig, for also being on this bill, and of course, the chairs of this committee for your interest, and all the members on this committee, because I would be surprised at this point if there's anyone on this committee who hasn't seen one of these presentations or heard from their county commissioners about these technology programs. And if you've missed that chance, please let me know and we will set one of those demonstrations up. It is truly jaw-dropping to sit in a chair and actually take an electronic SNAP application that's been processed at a state level where someone's gone to a portal, an online website, typed it all in. They think, oh, this is great, it's going into my database. And we are literally printing those out when we receive those at a county, putting them in front of our screens and typing in the application data that has already been entered. So when we're thinking about this issue, I like to think about it in terms of four lenses. The first one is, frankly, the staff and the workforce who are doing this work, which thank God we have folks who are interested in this. Think about the exhaustion. Think about the recruiting. Dana mentioned that it's tough to actually find people coming out of college or wanting to start their careers, and the first thing they see is they're going to be using a DOS-based or COBOL-based system. You know, counties already struggle trying to recruit their workforce. This is one of those hurdles that makes it even tougher. 2 years to become fluent. That's like learning a new language. In some cases, tougher. A 1,000-page manual, Mr. Chair, I know you've seen me in other committees bring 2 reams of paper just for the manual that people have to learn and become fluent with. And that's not considering the fiats, those workarounds that they have to do on every single application. One of those fiats can be 17 pages of a different manual they have to learn. And that's one system, not even one of the 12 systems we showcase, or I think we chose 6 for this committee, up on the screen before. And I like to also think about what this means for rural and what this means for metro counties. As you heard, I'm testifying on behalf of all the county organizations we have, rural, metro, suburban, regional centers. We are all united as a top priority this session for this. In rural Minnesota, I'm thinking about Representative Backer's district with Stacey Hennen, who's been in front of this committee before. They cannot lose anyone. They might only have 8 people doing the work in a joint powers for 6 or 7 counties. When they lose someone who knows how to do these applications, who might be fluent in 2 or 3 of these operating systems, it is a complete detriment. I think about the metro counties. I was thinking about Representative Fisher's district the other day. Just last year, Star Tribune reported that Ramsey County chose to hire close to 80 new eligibility services folks just to process the paperwork they have. So think about that for a tax-based stretch district, just like Representative Fisher's, about saying, hey, we want to do restorative justice initiatives. Hey, we want to invest in parks and transit, et cetera. But hey, at the same time, we're having wait times that are unacceptable. So because of these inefficiencies, we're having to use our levy dollars to hire 80 just eligibility determination workers. That brings us to the second lens, which is the property tax pressure. Mr. Kreitzer testified a little bit about just how inefficient these systems are. On average, a county can expect one worker, caseworker, to handle about 300 active SNAP, Medicaid, cash assistance programs at any given time. And talking with some of our colleagues in the Midwest and across the nation, they're at double or triple that. Wisconsin is talking about replacing their system right now, and they replaced theirs about 2 decades ago, and they're at one per around 800 to 900. So we are 300% less efficient. And what that means is your property tax dollars are paying for that inefficiency. Fraud prevention, identification, and program identification. It goes without saying that you saw a DOS-based green-based screen. These programs don't talk to each other. They don't have 21st century capabilities. And then, of course, I like to end with the client outcomes. And I hope we'll hear some testimony today about that aspect, too. At the end of the day, people who are applying for benefits and are qualified to receive benefits wait in a queue where they have no clue where they are in that queue.
They're already in a stressful situation, and it's made worse by these systems. And so from a client perspective, we are providing outcomes that are not acceptable as well. And I'll close with one thing, and it's actually from Representative Frederick's district. Just this week, we were celebrating one of our great public servants. His name is Bob Meyer. He's the county administrator for Blue Earth. For over 35 years of public service, he started his career as a Health and Human Services director. He ended as a county manager. And as he was giving his retirement speech to a large group of folks who came to celebrate him, he said, folks, I want to just say, when I started my career, my first week on the job, I was informed that Blue Earth County was going to be a pilot county for Maxis. And nothing has changed since then. 36 years of a full career, and that green screen that you saw is still the same system that folks are using. So we appreciate you all. We know this is tough. We know we're all being creative. Representative Frederick has bills up in committee later today in capital investment. We are trying to find a way to resource these major investments, but we really do appreciate the bipartisan support and urgency on this issue this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgard. Representative Nadeau, does that conclude the presentation portion before we go to other testifiers?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Next, we have Sydney Spreck from MAPE. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sydney Spreck, and I'm a political affairs coordinator at the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, or MAPE. MAPE is a union of over 18,000 state workers across all of Minnesota's agencies, boards, and commissions. I want to thank Representative Nadeau for introducing this bill, which reflects the very real technology needs being dealt with in human services programs, both at the county and state agency levels. So our state agency workers have to go into these programs as well to access data. Our state and counties need a more unified IT system that can cover multiple programs and communicate effectively as participants move between programs or are enrolled in multiple at once. The proposed steering committee would be an excellent body to plan for the consolidation of all of these systems and create an implementation plan that moves the state in that direction. We have one minor concern, which is the pulling of funding from agency operations to support the work of the steering committee. The Department of Human Services testified in the past that they are operating at around 2 to 3% of the agency's overall funding. This is extremely low for the size and number of programs and funds they oversee. The state should not continue to chip away at their operating funds for these different programs so that they can maintain their program integrity overall. We urge you to support this bill and add language instructing the steering committee to plan for an integrated human services system overall, as well as include a dedicated appropriation for the steering committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spreck, for your testimony. Next, we have Kyle Burnt and Aaron Hubert. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Burnt. I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 4675. We have been before this committee to highlight the growing delays in enrolling older Minnesotans into Medicaid for long-term care services. There's a handout in your packet that highlights this by county. These delays mean that residents who have a spend down are making choices about the care that they receive or delay because of their main choices isn't up to date and approved. Each of our associations have members who are carrying over $500,000 in unpaid Medicaid outstanding payments due to these delays. We recognize the underlying challenges to timely enrollment. So while we have a sense of urgency, we recognize change requires support and implementation of system changes that are necessary. I will turn it over to my colleague to complete our testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert, and I'm also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. With respect to Section 2 of the bill, we would urge the committee to consider inclusion of portal access to authorized enrolled providers so that they have better awareness of their clients' and residents' application status and critically are able to support them in their application process. While we appreciate that this bill is primarily focused on tech integration, systems modernization also includes process improvement. So whether through the steering committee in this bill or through another avenue, we would ask the legislature to consider three additional things. One, whether there is feasibility of presumptive eligibility for nursing facility and elderly waiver customized living. Whether we can streamline service agreements and care planning, including allowing providers to complete parts of a long-term care assessment and permitting facilities to work directly with lead agencies on behalf of residents. And then finally, whether there is value in creating a statewide applications review team to help lead agencies that have application backlogs, which I believe is a concept included in the governor's supplemental budget proposal. In light of a growing population of older adults, operating caps, and rising expenses, timely Medicaid enrollment is becoming a top priority for long-term care providers to address. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 4675? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member discussion on House File 4675. Representative Vernig.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Nadeau. I'm, like, super excited. This is the bill, one of the bills I've been waiting for. As you know, I have a similar bill that also outlines the listed projects. They're very similar. I, too, was a Hennepin County employee, so my first encounter with this was when I was doing reasonable accommodation requests and ergonomic assessments for eligibility staff, and they'd have two giant monitors and their laptop up, and they had these young people. You didn't know what these were. They were these programmable keyboards that were like this big, and because you couldn't use the mouse, and you had to memorize all the different shortcuts, and they didn't comply. They weren't compatible with like Dragon software. So if you needed voice activated software, they didn't really work well. And I thought there's got to be a better way to do this. And then I got elected, and it's been something that's sort of been on my radar from the very beginning. Last fall, when I met with Dakota County, it was very clear that caseworkers simply wanted to help families and that these systems just weren't delivering. So I'm really glad that you're doing this. Often we tell folks, like, you need to speed up and get moving, but these systems are so outdated. So I appreciate that there's a look at both the steering committee, some funding. I think we need to look long-term. What is this? It's not sexy, right? You don't do groundbreakings for IT systems like you do roads and bridges, but they are critical infrastructure. And Hennepin County, for example, does have IT teams that have built, bridge applications and things like that, but not every county has that, and we've heard that from across the state. So hopefully, we can do something this year. It is bipartisan. I know Representative Gilman has talked about this a lot. We need systems that can match our commitment to serving people in their time of need while ensuring, modern accountability, verification. It's achievable. We just have to prioritize it and have a plan. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you for hearing the bill. So, hopefully we can make some progress this year.
Thank you, Representative Vernig. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Nadeau, thank you for bringing this bill. It seems like we have multiple bills maybe going down parallel tracks to try to get this same thing done. Are we confident that we're going to be able to converge all of those into a single action that ultimately goes through Ways and Means and gets final approval, or are we still a little bit fractured as we push this along? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Nadeau, if you could tell us how this session's going to end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gander. If people will just listen to me, I think this would go a lot better. There are multiple tracks. There's a lot of ways that we can get things done.
I just hope that one of them works.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along that line, of course, the one that might eventually work could be kind of a summation of the several that are happening right now. And I hope we do have a process to bring all that into a final best result at the end of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gander. To that point, Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's about time. We have talked about system changes for a long time. As someone who has used the system at the county level in Hennepin County and managing it at the state level for 15 years, I've used that green screen, just to let you know. And so this is overdue, and this is the time that I think this is the year that we will find a comprehensive solution to make sure that not only Maxis, but MEC Square, the Met system, the PRISM, SSIS, you name it, there are many systems that need to be updated. We've talked about two today. The Met system was supposed to fix everything. When we had that Curum system a few years back, it never worked. But we're in 2026, and with the innovation that we have, with the AI and everything else, I assure you that we're not going to end the session until we get something to solve the challenges that we're faced with. So, Mr. Chair, thank you so much. There are many avenues, and I look forward to continuing this conversation before the end of session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for bringing this forward. And I've certainly heard from my old county commissioners the need for this, and I think we've heard about it statewide. But one question I would have would be, fast forward 5 years, the steering committee, what happens with that steering committee? Oftentimes, we'll set something up, resolve the problems, and then we're, it speaks in the bill about how the committee costs are and budgets are handled. What happens to this committee after 5 years and the funding that would finance it?
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jacobs. You know, if we get to the point where we no longer have technology changes, maybe we disband it. I was involved in basically doing the PID system for Hennepin County. We started that project 9 years. It took 9 years to change our assessing and our property tax reporting systems in Hennepin County. So I hope that we get to the point where we no longer need these things, but I think that's one of the pieces of, I think that's part of the magic of this particular bill, is that it's bringing those diverse partners together that are focusing on what are the problems that counties have in implementation, what are those issues that the federal government is putting on the states and the counties back, and how do we work together to make sure that we're trying to solve those in the most efficient possible way.
Mr. Hilgert.
Mr. Schoenmaker, if I could just add on, because I think this is a critical component of this whole package. And Representative Nadeau illustrated that great. But it is, I like to say that instead of a lowercase consultation, we're actually creating an uppercase collaboration in this steering committee. So for the first time ever, counties who operate these systems would actually be in the decision-making tree of what's the strategy. What is the prioritization? We need nimbleness. We need expediency. That those are critical things, but it all takes collaboration. We see our state partners as vital to this, and so this committee structure that we're creating via the steering committee is a first ever of its kind to give counties truly a little bit more power at that seat of decision making and just a little bit more control over their own destiny as we're still mandated to use these systems. So thanks for asking that question. We see it as a critical component of this bill.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So just so I understand, you see the steering committee as a permanent committee into perpetuity. It doesn't serve a purpose, get the problems resolved, and then end. You see it as a permanent committee?
Mr. Hilgert.
Mr. Schoenmaker, Chair Schoenmaker, Representative Jacob, I do defer to Representative Nadeau on his author's intent of this. When we came to him to talk about this bill to us represents really like, let's focus on the most immediate, urgent projects that we can and should do now to help us with a variety of efficiencies and client benefits. And so if you look to Section 2, that list, we don't know how long that could take. That could take year, two, three, more. So it's unclear about how long this committee stays forward. But I will tell you transparently, if we're successful in this, I do see this as a vehicle for the conversations that Representative Knorr is talking about, of are we using this structure to actually make the comprehensive investments and some of the systems transformation. So I think it's unclear about that.
And Representative Jacobs and Chair Schumacher, I mean, I do see this as an ongoing, you know, if you read the bill, it talks about having quarterly meetings. One of the examples that I'll bring out that we initiated a number of years ago was called CJCC, and it was a collaboration of public safety officials. It was suburban prosecutors. It was district court judges. It was corrections officers. It was human services. It was public defenders. And it brings all of those partners together that looks at how do we make our system more efficient? Where are we losing people? Where are we spending money that we shouldn't have to? And I look at this as we need more collaboration. I mean, lots more between agencies and counties. I mean, at some point in time, I mean, look at what I'll bring up HR1. There are challenges that the state has in dealing with eligibility and work requirement and volunteer hours. There is technology that we need to build in order to be compliant, to reduce error rates. And in my mind, the only way that can happen is with increased collaboration between the people who are mandated and responsible to provide and do that data and the state who is basically providing those systems that we're forced to work in.
Representative Jacob.
That's all. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Knorr. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you've already noted, this, it's a state supervised county and tribal government administered. Have we consulted with the tribal government in this whole process?
Mr. Hilgert.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, we've talked about this at our county tribal meeting, but we are open to any appropriate inclusion of whatever the tribes prefer to be part of this table. As you know, there are initiative tribes that actually operate these systems as well. So we certainly want them at that table and to choose what representation they want on this steering committee.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the other second question, Representative Maduro, you talked about the HR1. Do we know if we're getting any federal funding to support the adjustment to the changes that we're supposed to be implementing from the federal government?
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Schumacher and Chair Knorr. There is $200 million in HR1 that's available for states to apply to, and I want to say that Minnesota has gotten a couple of grants already, smaller, I want to say between $3 and $5 million. So there are funds that we're eligible to apply for. And that's as far as I can tell you right now. There's so little guidance coming from the feds on some of these implementation things, but that's as much as I know.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on also the prescription of what needs to be changed, I see that blue screen scripting needs to be, so we can create a more case notes and everything done. Do we need to put in legislation? Because if that blue zone is updated, you lose everything and you start over again. What is the plan going forward? Because this is not the end all be all solution, because we're describing technological changes in this statute.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Knorr and Chair Schumacher. I think that's what this bill is about. It's about bringing those requisite partners together to identify those things. Where's the low hanging fruit? What can we do quickly? And I don't look at this as, I mean, I look at this as hopefully to solve those acute problems that we have today with interaction. But you know, it's also looking long term and getting ahead of whatever we can and trying to foresee some of those things, or recognizing that something that works in Hennepin may work someplace else. Something that works in in Cook County may work in Hennepin. And to me, that's what this is about.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to seeing the APD and also making sure that we do have this 90, 75, or 50% federal share for any of the system updates that we are working on. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Final word, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and Chair Norr, for hearing this bill. Members, I appreciate you entering into the discussion. One of the things that we oftentimes don't see is, you know, we get to hear from each other. We get to hear from department directors. But you know what? We very, very seldom get to hear from the actual case managers and financial workers that really do this unseen, behind-the-scenes, difficult work. And we talk about attracting employees, and we talk about retaining them, and yep, there's all kinds of things that we do at the county level to do that. But those are the people that we rely on. Every one of our systems relies on those employees that are working in these systems every day. And I hope that we will move this forward and that we'll start actually collaborating and coordinating some of these systems. And I'm super optimistic, and thank you, members.
With that, House File 4675 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Next, we have Representative DePell with House File 4715, and I will move that House File 4715 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, Representative DePell. When you are ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and Chair Norr and members of the committee. What this bill does is it sets up an automated process. So when you have forecasted budgets within health that overrun beyond 5 or 10 or beyond 10%, there are systems in place, much like any organization would have that has budgets, that would alert and notify either the chair of this committee or chairs of this committee, or if it reached a higher threshold, it would then go on to notify multiple committees that would have oversight into this budget and the services otherwise provided. And then if it exceeds over 10%, it would require legislative action to continue that program so long as in statute there aren't already required items that would say this program has to continue because it's critical. Certainly we don't want to cut programs that are critical for Minnesotans, but the intent of this bill would to provide automated oversight that would give notifications and reports to this committee and other committees that would have jurisdiction over it.
All right. Thank you, Representative DePell. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 4715? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member questions? Seeing Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. Just a technical question specifically to this. It looks like it impacts the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Is that correct?
It would impact, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. That's an excellent question. Yes, this would impact committees that would have oversight within programs that have been forecasted within the health purview that have overruns, per se. So, as I mentioned earlier, the 5, 10, or over 10%.
Representative Hicks.
Would this include foster care?
Representative DePell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and another excellent question. Certainly, again, as I had mentioned earlier, that if there are already provisions within bills for funding that would cause these programs to continue, even if there was an overrun, however, there would still be reports made, so the committees were alerted to those overruns. They would continue, much like the foster care system or any other program that we have. And so the intent of this bill is to protect, for instance, the foster care program or any other program that exists from being defrauded. So the individuals that are working within those programs, they have the funding necessary, and they have the services that have been guaranteed by the state. Those individuals that have applied and been accepted to those, and so, yes.
Representative Hicks.
Representative Dipple, who controls the foster care funding in the state of Minnesota?
I am unaware of that, and I would be happy to defer to either you, because I believe you have extensive experience in that, and I would respect your insights on that.
Representative Hicks.
It's counties and tribes, just so it's clear, lead agencies. This is why these types of bills make me frustrated, because the people who decide, the people who get the money, the people who write the checks, are our county partners. We send the money to them, and they pay the foster parents. So when we talk about things like this will cut the fraud to the counties, to the foster parents, where is the fraud in the foster care program? We have several county partners here today. Is anyone concerned that they're committing fraud? If we're going to be serious about things that actually impact fraud, could we at least know what the things are that we're impacting before we bring forth solutions? Our counties are already drowning. They are drowning. And we are saying, but we're going to do this. We just spent, I don't know, like an hour and a half listening to them talk about how they're drowning. I don't think our county governments are committing fraud. I just don't. Maybe they are, and if someone is aware, we should really have that conversation. But I would really, really like to focus on things that address the fraud with the providers that are committing it, not foster parents and counties.
Representative DePell.
Thanks, Chair Schumacher. And again, I would just reiterate that the intent of this bill is to make sure that any program that exists would get continued funding, but would also have a generated report by said agency if there are significant overrides in expenses. And so, again, this is the way that all organizations operate. And if this is an issue in our state, as I think everybody has acknowledged, it's important to remember that every program should have the scrutiny that taxpayers, I think, are demanding right now. Taxpayers are demanding that we make sure that we understand if there was a forecasted budget, but we've gone over 5 or 10 or even a greater percentile, that somebody hasn't found a loophole within that program. And that's to make sure that foster kids are taken care of. That's to protect the budgets of the counties. It's to protect the budgets of the state. So ultimately, the intent of this bill, most assuredly, is not to undercut or handicap counties or foster parents, without question. It is not. And so I appreciated the presentation earlier. That is absolutely true. That is the number one priority of every county that I talk to, as mentioned by the representative. They need systems modernization. It's something that should move forward, and I believe this modernizes our ability to understand if there are overruns within budgets.
Representative Hicks.
I respect that lens, but as someone who has spent a lot of time in human services and has listened to our counties talk about unfunded mandates, particularly from your side of the aisle, to be frank, when you say the agency's responsible, you're implying that that's the state agencies. And they will be the ones to compile the report. But the entities that will have to send them that information are the counties. It is another request to our counties to do more with less with systems that aren't working. And I just, at what point does that break? And I, to be fair, I understand that we need to have mandates on our county sometimes. But given the current situation and what they're sharing with us about where they are at with these cuts from all morning and all this cycle,
I just am uncomfortable asking them to do one more thing with less. Because when you say agency, you're talking about the state agency. But that information comes from our counties because we are county administered. There's no way around that at this point unless we as a legislature make significant changes in that space. So it just, we can't just keep talking in circles about we need to do this thing and this thing and this thing and then out of one side of our mouths and then the other side of our mouth say we can't keep putting more burdens on our counties. Those two things are in contradiction. So we have to decide where our priorities lie.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then with all due respect, Representative Hicks, we don't know when there is fraud happening unless one of our, well, I'll use Lou Ragus as an example. When he breaks the story, we're like, oh, there's fraud in this area. So I think what the bill is trying to do is maybe grab some more, a little more guardrails, perhaps, so we don't have to rely on the one journalist in the state that is actually doing journalism and not activism, alerting us to the fraud in our programs. I think that's really what he's trying to do, not trying to attack the counties at all. But, I mean, it is embarrassing as lawmakers when we have another story come out and our taxpayers are saying, well, why didn't you know about this, right? I think this really is what he's trying to attempt to do.
Representative Corinne.
Thank you, Chair. My primary concern that I have with this bill lies with Section 6 at the bottom of page 4, with service terminations. And unless I'm misinterpreting, I understand this to say that if a program or service exceeds a projected spending by more than 10%, then the commissioner must terminate that program. Is that essentially correct?
Representative DePell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question. And that is a very good question. What it also states is that those programs will not be immediately terminated if it is otherwise specified in the funding mechanism or statute that it shouldn't be immediately terminated, because many programs are very sensitive and people depend on these services. We can't just terminate a service out of the blue on individuals because there are other people abusing them. And so I'm not sure if that's at the heart of your question. It is a very good question, and it's extremely appropriate to ask, because we really provide essential services to many individuals in Minnesota. What this would do is continuously put the spotlight on that to make sure that there isn't fraud going on in there, and so those services for the people that are depending on them can continue to get them, and we don't have the cost overruns that kind of rob them of their services.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. There's another side as well I just want to offer to increase spending that's not nefarious, that's not fraud. We know that fraud exists and we're tackling those issues, but we can't forget that part of increased spending in human services is attributable to the growing need of services for people. And we've seen an exponential increase over the years of needs for services that directly translates into needing more money to fund these services and directly translates to the state of Minnesota spending more than we thought we might, because we offer these services, we offer more accessibility, and more people who are able and who qualify for programs are getting the access. We're doing our job so they get that access. And we are underestimating often how many people will be able to now access those programs. And we're seeing people jump on programs in numbers that we didn't expect, but it doesn't mean that they don't need those services. And so I'm really concerned about having this. To me, it seems if we have spending that is over 10%, we should know why. I think that is a very, very simple, agreeable, idea that we should know why budgets are off with our spending. But when we're hearing things from the governor, like we need to slow the growth in human services, that equates to cuts. We can't slow the growth of people who have disabilities. We can't slow what people have, and we can't slow what people's needs are. So I'm really, really concerned that there's a lot of statutes out there that don't explicitly say that this program can't be shut down. And without clarity, DHS, we don't know in any given case if they will decide that they do have the power to close a program or they don't have a power to close a program. That remains unclear, and I think that would remain unclear with this language, and I would be really afraid that we'd be terminating programs that we're actually seeing an increased need for.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dipple, the question I have is in Section 8, particularly around lines 7.7 through 7.15, where it talks about mandatory medical-assisted benefits, that if there's an increased forecast that's more than 10%, that the commissioner must in aggregate prospectively reduce payment rates going forward. Can you tell me a little bit how that would work or what that would look like?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think that's also a very good question. I think these things actually run in concert and parallel with the systems modernization presentation that was given a little bit earlier. And these items, I think, all need to be updated and addressed in a way where there's information that's given that is extremely useful and semi-automated in systems that talk to one another and give the best benefits and outcome to Minnesotans in who pay taxes, who pay the property taxes, as we just heard about, and individuals who expect these things. And so within the question that you just asked, I think that I just tried to paint a slightly broader picture of it, but within that, there are budget constraints. As we know, we're coming up to a forecasted deficit, and I do not want anybody to lose their services that they are depending on, and that is actually the intent of the bill here is in all of these programs that could have forecasted overruns. Since we operate on a finite budget, we have finite tax dollars that we can collect and then implement programs through to serve our communities. I think within your question of making sure that we continue to deliver what individuals expect is also wrapped up in the making sure that we don't have individuals either abusing the system or causing a cost overrun. That's why we have the 5%, which is kind of like the little red light, and then the 10%, which is the big red light, and then the over 10%, which is the flashing red light. Something is wrong here. We have gone way over, and this is not something that we can afford any longer. And so that is kind of the beyond critical point of we need to make sure we can still deliver these services.
All right, and members, we have 8 minutes and one more bill that relates to Governor's proposal piece, and so Representative Fisher.
Thank you. And this is kind of concerning as I'm looking at this. Is if I'm looking at the section, is basically what you're telling the commissioner to do, if I'm understanding, and I couldn't pick it up from your, as you're going into this big explanation, is that you're telling the commissioner to go out and reduce payments to medically mandatory medical assistance benefits. So does that mean if to bring things in line, we have to start cutting reimbursement rates to nursing homes? Does it mean we're recutting reimbursement rates to assisted living? Does this mean we're cutting reimbursement rates to hospitals for the services that they provide? And the reason I'm asking this, we're already understanding that right now we hear from the nursing homes and the long care imperative about the problems that they have, that our rates we have right now are not covering current costs. And so if all of a sudden we're cutting rates out there for medically necessary benefits, and all of a sudden we find out, okay, we may find that we're driving people out from providing services. Legitimate providers who are providing the services all of a sudden have the rates cut, and all of a sudden people are no longer getting services, period. That's what I feel the consequence of this paragraph is that when you make these kind of cuts and to tell the commissioner, go ahead, oh, just make these cuts, make up the 10%, could cause real damage to not only our people receiving vulnerable services, our vulnerable people receiving assisted living, nursing care. You know, I've not seen the list of all the mandatory medical assistant benefits that are out there, but we could be talking a large section of our population. So we need a little bit more information on this before we can move forward. I just feel that this section here is extremely problematic and would do severe harm potentially to people who really need these services.
Thank you, Representative Fisher, and we will be laying this bill over. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No comments.
Okay. 10-second final word, Representative DePell.
Yeah, thank you, Representatives, and thank you, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your morning.
With that, House File 4715 is laid over. Next, we have House File 4684, Representative Robbins. I will move that House File 4684 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Robbins, welcome to the committee. When you are ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill. This is one of many that came out of work at the Fraud Committee to help us cut down on fraud. It was the idea is to have GPS tracking and rear-facing cameras in providers for non-emergency medical transportation so that we can verify the routes that they are using and the number of passengers they are taking on these visits. We found in testimony that it's not uncommon. So a provider might say they're taking a certain route, but actually they're taking a closer route but charging for the longer route, or that they say they're taking one person, but they really have six people in their van, but they're charging for six individual trips. So these suggestions have bipartisan support in the Fraud Committee, and we hope to get your support as well.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. First for testimony, we have Morgan Roth. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Schumacher, Co-Chair Knorr, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Roth, and I am the State Government Affairs Lead for Samsara. Samsara is a U.S.-based company that provides operations and fleet management technology across critical sectors, partnering extensively with public entities to enhance the safety, efficiency, and transparency of their services. We partner with hundreds of local government governments nationwide, including dozens here in Minnesota, such as Hennepin County, the airports, and Minneapolis Public School. I'm here to share an overview of the technologies currently available to address many of the state's challenges and express Samsara's support of House File 4684, which seeks to increase NEMT accountability through the use of GPS, camera technology, and trip forms. We recognize the challenges this committee faces in protecting the integrity of the NEMT system, ensuring vulnerable Minnesotans receive vital rides while safeguarding taxpayer dollars as a critical priority. And we understand that without implementing these solutions to these challenges, NEMT offerings could be at risk, potentially straining other emergency services. Today, industries across the economy deploy technologies that meet this committee's objectives. Indeed, it has become industry standard to utilize telematics and dash cameras along with digitally connected forms to ensure transparency and accountability in government services. That's what this bill aims to achieve, the strategic application of these technologies to help the state deliver accountability. Securing the NEMT system requires digitizing operational data. Today, telematics systems can provide auditable records of location, routes, timestamps, and mileage that helps agencies verify trips and detect discrepancies. When paired with dash camera technology, state auditors can verify occupant totals. This ensures billed trips accurately match the passengers transported and the miles traveled. Crucially, passenger verification is fully compatible with privacy protections, safeguarding rider privacy and dignity while improving transportation accountability. Advanced systems can automatically blur faces and other personally identifiable information, critical for maintaining public trust. The technological capacity to secure the NEMT program exists today. Embracing this digital transformation will save critical time and taxpayer dollars for Minnesota. We applaud Representative Robbins for bringing forward this practical legislation, and we urge your support. Thank you, co-chairs, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Roth, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 4684? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. And my question is for you, Morgan. Really quick, the current draft of this bill specifically mentions GPS. Can you describe the differences for us at the in this committee between GPS and telematics, please?
Thank you. And
Minister
before
Roth.
Sorry, I'll just jump in. I just want to say for the record that we are working on an amendment to include telematics in here, but we're working on that language to make sure it meets the needs of rural NEMT providers. That's why I didn't bring the amendment forward today, but we will have an amendment ready for markup if you choose to include the bill.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Mr. Roth.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you both, representatives. It's a great question. Essentially, GPS can be a number of different devices that can capture a global position. It could be anything from like a Garmin watch to a navigation system already built into a vehicle. A telematics device is actually going to get plugged into the ODB port of a vehicle and pull actual diagnostic information from the engine, which is very critical in ensuring that there's no tampering of that information. And so coupled with the digitized forms and the camera systems, et cetera, it basically authenticate verified information of that trip.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I just have a quick question about when these services are provided by counties using volunteer drivers. Would this apply to them as well when counties are billing for these services using volunteer drivers?
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hicks. My understanding it would apply to anyone who is billing Medicaid.
Okay.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. So I think that means yes. So just something to consider. That means our volunteer drivers who are not paid to support our counties in providing this work would have to install these on their personal vehicles, and counties would have to pay for it. So again, I just want to remind everyone that would be another thing we're doing to our counties.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've got a long way to go because I'm looking at the EVV as part of the global solution that we're planning to implement going forward. And I know that you're adding the camera that is included in there. So some of the questions that we have is the sections for Chapter 13 for data privacy, including HIPAA, including ADA, Section 504, the civil rights, looking at that whole piece of the data that is being collected. For that individual, I don't see any sections that really stress on all those. I know we have got a sections in the EVV process because it's a more of a single system within the global context of how we do electronic verification. Are we going to be including all those sections as we go forward? I know we have sections in our to be discussed bill.
And Representative Robbins, if you could answer that with your closing comments as well, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Noor. So I am a huge data privacy protection person. I share your concerns on that, and my understanding is that it can be done through the contracts, and so it wouldn't necessarily be needed in the statute because we would be doing it through the contracts, and that's how it's often handled when this type of technology is currently deployed across the strait in DOT and the counties already. But if it's needed, I would be happy to add that. So I'm on board with all the data protections that would be required. And I hope you'll support the bill, members. NEMT is honestly a huge source of fraud, and this is a very simple fix that would really help crack down on the fraud in this area. So we ask for your support. Thank you.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 4684 be laid over. And members, with that, we get to be back here, 8:15, tomorrow morning. See you then. We're adjourned.